Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If you look back into the history of almost any long-standing New England family, you'll probably find some combination of the following: farmers, laborers, ministers, spinsters, academics, writers, soldiers. But when that family is the Lowells, the list also includes college presidents, abolitionists, lawyers, inventors, astronomers, factory owners, and Pulitzer Prize-winning poets. A family as complex as the more than 300 years of American history they've lived through. Well, author Nina Sankovich tells the story of the venerable Massachusetts family from their arrival in the 1600s to the 20th century in her fascinating new book, The Lowells of Massachusetts, An American Family. And she joins us now from NPR in New York. Nina Sankovich, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello, thank you.
It's great to have you. So I'm curious if you could just tell us the genesis story of this fantastic book of yours, because I understand you really wanted to start writing about or you wanted to arrive at a place where you could write about Amy Lowell. Why her?
Well, I have been fascinated with Amy Lowell since the second grade. I was given a poetry project back then, and although I didn't do too well on the project, I became just obsessed with Amy Lowell. And fast forward a few decades, and I was researching a book on letter writing. So I thought, oh, I'm going to look up the letters of Amy Lowell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to my horror, I discovered that she had in her last will and testament a provision that after her death, all of her personal letters should be burned.
Wow. Yeah.
So I was kind of horrified by that. And then it turned out that many members of her family had that same provision. So then I started thinking, what are these Lowells hiding? You know, what are they trying to do, burning their personal letters? You know, are they curating their image? And that set me off really on a kind of detective hunt. I was going to find out the true stories of the Lowells, the story of Amy and of her siblings. But once I got into the first Lowell, Percival Lowell, who came over in 1639, his story was so fascinating. So then I was just hooked. 10 generations of Lowells I ended up researching. And luckily, I did find plenty of letters sketchbooks and journals and diaries and all kinds of papers.
Well, just so for folks who don't know, Amy Lowell is the Pulitzer Prize winning poet that we referred to earlier. But before we sort of take this march through history with the Lowell family, were you able to determine why they had this strange family ritual of ordering that their letters be burned upon each Lowell's death?
Well, you know, not all of them had that in their will, but it was apparently a sort of common practice in the 19th century. And it was this idea of exactly that, of curating the image you left behind, of not leaving anything too personal behind.
Ah, okay. Oh, interesting. That sounds, I was about to say, that sounds very Puritan, but is that?
Yeah.
But maybe we should just talk about the first Lowell himself, Percival, whom you mentioned. 1639, that's the year that he and his wife arrived?
Yeah. Okay. And what is so interesting about Percival is that he decided to emigrate to America at the age of 68.
Right.
So that is a ripe old age in those days, particularly, to take off on a 9-week voyage across the sea and start over completely in a, you know, just a new country in a tiny town. He came from the town of Bristol, which was this thriving port town. You know, he'd had a pretty cosmopolitan life, and to leave that behind and then go to, you know, this rural Puritan enclosed village was really quite a big change for him.
What was Percival's station in life in Bristol?
He was an importer-exporter. The Lowells had a coat of arms that they had paid for during the reign of Queen Elizabeth, so they were so-called gentlemen. But times were hard in England in 1639. There were all kinds of taxes and fees that Percival had to pay. There were a lot of bribes he had to pay to keep his business going. Harvests had failed for the second year in a row. Disease was rampant. I mean, it's really unbelievable that both Percival and his wife made it into their 60s. There was a new war threatening. Charles I wanted to go to war against Scotland in the Bishop's Wars. And just things were not good. So
right.
Percival just decided to pack up, and he and his party of 13 took off across the sea.
It is an amazing story, given the age, as you said, that he was. And so when he landed on these shores, again, what did he take his privilege and his money with him, or I mean, because America was such a different place.
Right, right. Well, he certainly brought his money with him, which allowed him to buy into the town. But he arrived in Boston, and he had met someone from the town of Newbury, the really village of Newbury, on the voyage over. So he decided to take his crew north to Newbury. And the town was happy to have him, but he and his family had to really agree to live by the dictates of the town. They had to be accepted into the town, which they did because they saw that this was, you know, a real opportunity for them to put down roots. And it was a congregational town, so there were strict, you know, Puritan dictates. But really what resonated for Percival and what you see then throughout the history of the Lowells was there was in the town, you had to work very, very hard, develop your individual talents for the good of the entire town.
Uh-huh.
So you weren't just there for your family or for yourself. You really had to put your all into it for the good of the whole community. And because it wasn't a big community, your roles could be multiple. I mean, you could be both a farmer and someone who worked in government. A woman who, whereas in England, had very strict and limited roles, so all of a sudden she comes to America, she could be a mother, an apothecary, a midwife. And so there's an incredible kind of flourishing of opportunity combined with this duty to community that I just found so interesting.
Interesting. And so how does that sort of animating force in the Lowells of America play out, let's jump forward more than a century here, in the American Revolution?
Well, it was interesting to see how the Lowells had to really arrive at a place where they left behind their duty to the king, which was really sort of they had been bred to be dutiful, citizens, loyal subjects to the King of England. Things had to get to such a point that they reinvented what their community was. Now their community was no longer England as a whole, but this new possible country. And that wasn't an easy decision to make. That wasn't an easy transformation to make. But to go through the documents and see how they arrived at that and how they then sort of redefined their community and their duty to this new community of this, you know, the colonies coming together to form a new country, that was how this Lowell sense of duty then, you know, transformed itself during the revolutionary period.
Fascinating. Well, you know, it's so interesting, the Lowells that you write about in the book, we could spend our entire conversation talking about any single one of them.
Absolutely.
But there are a couple of others I do want to hear about their stories, because we need to talk about Francis Cabot Lowell.
Okay.
He's the Lowell who gives us the Lowell, the name of the city of Lowell
that
we know today. But tell us about him.
Well, he was interesting. I mean, all of them were interesting to me, but he was what was called a happy genius at mathematics when he was at Harvard. And after leaving Harvard, he wanted to go into trade. So he had this opportunity to go to France and travel around France, where he got there in the middle of the revolution. But the revolution really didn't bother him at all. He was just kind of picking up knowledge about what were the good things to trade with France. And then he came back and built up his trade. So later, you know, like when then there was an embargo on goods, and he had this during the Jefferson's presidency, he had this idea, okay, it's not going to be easy for me to trade anymore. Maybe it's time for the United States to really start building up its manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no one better at manufacturing than England. So I'm going to go to England and figure out how they do it. Now, in England at the time, they had very strict controls over who got into a mill and, you know, saw how the looms worked, how manufacturing happened. If you worked for one of these manufacturers, you could not leave the country. You were prohibited from emigrating.
They're protecting their intellectual property.
Really, fortress-like. Yeah. But somehow he wormed his way into these factories, and he walked around. He didn't take any notes. He kind of walked around whistling, his hands in his pocket, you know, looking like the sweet American. And he picked it all up. He just looked at everything, locked it away in his brain. And then he came back to the U.S. And in fact, on his way back, the British stopped his ship and they searched through all of his luggage. They said, this guy must, you know, he's been looking at our mills. He must have something. But they couldn't find anything because it was all in his head.
Mm.
So they had to let him go. He got back to Boston. He sat down, redrew everything, actually made the looms better, made the whole system better. And he was really determined to not only make the machinery better, but to make the system of the mill towns better.
Yeah.
He was in England during the Luddite Revolution, and he just saw, you know, these workers are miserable, their conditions are miserable. And he had this ideal of what he wanted, these campus-like factories where people, you know, worked hard, but they also had a clean place to live, and they had education opportunities, and they were paid in cash. And the people he wanted to work in his mills were the farmers' daughters of New England, because he knew they worked hard. He knew they wanted to get off the farm and out from under their parents and finally have some money of their own. And he offered them this opportunity. And under Francis Cabot Lowell, these mills were operated that way. Unfortunately, after his death,
it didn't stay that
changed.
Way. Exactly. Right. I was going to say that, like the history of the mills and Lowell is a complicated one.
Absolutely.
But here's also another one of those inflection points that the family sort of represents along with the moment that we find ourselves in American history, right? Because on the one hand, we have Reverend Charles Lowell, famed abolitionist, right, who just who thunders against things like the Fugitive Slave Act. But on the other hand, the very mills, the Lowell mills that we're talking about, benefited from the cheap price of Southern cotton because of slavery.
Yeah, absolutely. And the mill owners also relied on the South for cash.
Yeah.
You know, when there were times of, you know, financial panic, they needed Southern cash to keep going. And that was something that I saw, you know, throughout the history of the Lowells, was they did not always agree on what their obligation was. They didn't always agree on how they defined the community for which they were working. And so to see that play out, it was really a difficult period for the Lowells, and it was really the wealthier Lowells versus the less wealthy, in fact, even poor Lowells. They took the opposite sides on this. Now, when the Civil War began, they joined together again, really united in their desire to keep the Union whole.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about another one here, another one of the Lowells,
okay,
very briefly, because we just got a couple of minutes left. Abbott Lawrence Lowell, 22nd president of Harvard University, a controversial figure in Harvard's history.
Very. Absolutely controversial. And, you know, the way that I saw Lawrence was that he defined his community in such a way that he kept out elements that he did not think fit the ideal college community. And that was a real problem, because that meant driving gay students out, allowing black students to study at Harvard, but not allowing them to live in, you know, the residences with the other students. Having a quota on how many Jewish students there could be. So these are the kinds of things that Lawrence did that we, you know, are very controversial.
Yeah.
But we can't forget all the good things that he did for Harvard also. And, you know, he really built the Harvard both physically and the way the university is run, the way it is still run today, you know, the way majors are and concentrations and the honors program and the housing program. And he broke up where all of the wealthier students lived on this Gold Coast, and he broke that up and said, no, all the students have to live together. Mm. He had this idea of brotherhood, but he excluded large groups of people from that brotherhood.
Yeah. So we've just got a minute or so here to go. I love the idea that this family and its journey through American history tells us a lot about how we view community and how we view duty to whatever that community is that we're defining. I mean, I'm wondering how you think, what lessons we can learn today from the example of the Lowells.
Well, what I really found at times inspiring about the Lowells was this idea that you are a part of a community and you owe something to that community. You owe your hard work, you owe your allegiance. And it's not a community that's defined by who your family is. It's a community that's defined by however you want to define it. And I think the more broadly we define it, the better we are off as a country. And when I look back at the history of the Lowells, the broader they defined their community, the better kind of things that they did. And so I think that's our lesson. Our lesson is that our American community is a large community. We should all be working to help each other, you know, achieve better things, achieve a greater a greater way of living, greater employment opportunities, that limiting it to people of your social tier, of your family alone, is really dangerous.
Yeah. And another minor lesson, don't burn your letters.
Yeah.
or don't delete your emails, if that's the modern day analogy. Nina Sankovic, author of the new book, The Lowells of Massachusetts, An American Family. It's a truly fantastic read. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And by the way, I should say that Nina will be speaking at the Concord Bookshop on May 7th and at the Harvard Bookstore on May 12th. We've got information about that at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.